Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. And today's show, I'm going to focus on, you get to hear me for the whole hour. I'm going to be focusing on blogs that came out in Psychology Today. Last year, I talked about the top 10 blogs, and today I thought I would share stuff from my bottom 10 blogs. I've published over 160 blogs over the past 2 years, and it's always very interesting to note which blogs had the fewest readers. And it seems like some dumb luck, because sometimes a blog seems quite important and few readers look at it, and other times blogs seem not particularly important and it's read by tens of thousands of people. So I wanted to share stories from the unpopular blogs because I think they're important. So the first story I would like to share is one that I have presented at many medical conferences over the years. It presents some ethical questions, as you will hear, and I published this as a set of three blogs, and maybe that's why it wasn't read very much, because people didn't want to read three parts. But here's a story, and see what you think. So it's a story about a 19-year-old patient of mine. He had cystic fibrosis, and as listeners to this program will know, cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease that creates many lung problems as well as digestive problems. And at the time of this story, the average person with cystic fibrosis lived to the early 20s. Now, thanks to newfangled treatments, people are living into their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and a baby born today with cystic fibrosis has a good chance to have a normal lifespan. So we've made great strides in treatment of this illness. But this is a story that takes place 25 years ago. The patient in question I had met when he was 14 years old. He had been in the hospital every 2 to 3 months because of lung infections for which he received intravenous antibiotic therapy. And the first day I met him, I said to him, your x-ray shows that your right lung is very, very diseased. It's useless. It does not provide you any breathing capacity. And it's the source of all the infections that land you in the hospital all the time. So I suggested that he have that lung removed surgically. This was the first encounter. They didn't quite trust me. They got a second opinion, and they concurred that the lung should come out, and it did. And he did much better for the next several years. This was around the time that I had started doing some counseling with patients. That's actually kind of a funny story. I referred my patients with cystic fibrosis to our child psychiatrist, and he asked me if I would come along to break the ice. At first, I protested I was too busy, but then he prevailed upon me to go. And in fact, I interviewed this psychiatrist, Dr. David Keith. There was a previous broadcast about him on this show, and he told me that if I had said no, I didn't want to accompany a patient, he would have told me to find a different psychiatrist. I didn't know that. Did not know that at the time, but I accompanied my patients to see him, and I participated in the family therapy in which he engaged. And after a while, he told me, hey, you can do this on your own, because he saw that I had, I guess, some natural talent in facilitating discussions. So with this particular patient I'm telling you about, the 19-year-old, I had started doing counseling with him when he was about 16, and we were very close. He told me at one point that he could tell me things he would never tell anyone else, including his parents, which meant a lot. When I counsel patients, they will tell me things that are private, but at that time I did not know of such a world. So came a day, he went to college at the university just next to the CF Center in Syracuse because he wanted to have access in case he had a medical problem. His family lived 3 hours away. Came a day and he was rushed to the emergency room at early in the morning. He had coughed up a lot of blood. Now, many cystic fibrosis patients, the way they die is from coughing up blood, and they basically bleed out. And he was rushed to the hospital. I saw him. He thought he was going to die. I told him we would try to stop the bleeding, and he said to me, okay, but I don't want to be put on a ventilator. A ventilator is a machine that breathes for you, and the reason he said that is because he knew, like many of my patients did, that when patients with cystic fibrosis end their life at put on ventilators, they tend not to come off, and so they might need mechanical ventilation for a few weeks, and then they die anyway. And he did not want to suffer, so that was the reason he told me he didn't want to put on a ventilator. I said, no, we won't do that. I understand your wishes, and I said, but to try to stop the bleeding, we will need to put you on the ventilator temporarily, so we can do surgery to try to fix it. It'll be like other surgical procedures you've had before. He said, that's okay with me. He then took off his ring, and he said, please give this to my girlfriend. And I said, you can give it back. You can give it to her yourself. And he said, no, please do it. And I said, okay, if I have to. And then he says, I love you, which is very unusual for me to hear in those days. And I said, I love you back. Although I'll share with you, the audience, that now I'm quite open in saying I love my patients because I do feel a strong connection to most of them. So he underwent the procedure. The bleeding stopped. He woke up the next morning. He felt better. But there was so much blood in his lungs that by evening his lungs sort of shut down and he slipped into a coma. And the intensivist in the intensive care unit said, you have to intubate him, put him back in the ventilator, or he's going to die. And I said, but he doesn't want to be on the ventilator. And she said, well, if you don't put him on the ventilator, he's going to die. So I wasn't sure what to do because he told me he didn't want to be on the ventilator, and yet I thought he had a small chance to live. So I called an ethicist. So hospitals employ people who specialize in medical ethics, and the ethicist on call that night actually knew cystic fibrosis well. He had been one of our cystic fibrosis physicians. So I told him the situation, and he said, well, either choice is correct. If you don't put him on a ventilator and let him die, you'll be fulfilling his wishes. And if you do put him on the ventilator because you think he has a chance to live, he might get mad at you that you didn't listen to his request. But you would be acting within the role of a physician to keep him alive. I should also tell you that his family had arrived in the hospital by then, and they told me that I should make the choice. I think that was good. In today's world, oftentimes we say, let the family make the choice, or let the patient make the choice. But I think that having the family make the choice is unfair in some ways, because whatever the choice is, they'll have to live with it for the rest of their lives. I think it's far better if a physician knows the family and patient well, let the physician choose. And so after I spoke with the ethicist, I said, that wasn't very helpful. He told me either choice was correct, so what should I do? And I said, well, if there's no one correct choice, I'm going to make the decision based on my own understanding. And a verse from the Bible came to me. As many of you know, I'm Jewish, and I often come up with Jewish ideas. And the verse was from the book of Deuteronomy. Moses says to the children of Israel, I set before you life and death, choose life. And I said, okay, I stand, I'm going to choose life. If he doesn't do well, he can always take him off the ventilator, he can die. But if he dies, there's no way of returning. But what about my promise that I wouldn't put him on a ventilator? So what I did was I recused myself as his attending physician and let the intensivist take over for 5 minutes. She put him on a ventilator, and then I became his physician again. So I actually ask people when I tell this story what they would do. If you were in a position to decide should he put him on the ventilator or not, what choice would you make? And when I've asked this question in medical conferences, the vast majority of people say they would respect his wishes and let him die. And the reason is that we really believe in patient autonomy. If it was in writing that he wanted me, had an advanced directive and he wanted me not to put him on a ventilator, I could place myself in some legal jeopardy to disrespect his wish. But I knew this patient well, and I thought that this was the right choice on his behalf. Next day, he was in a coma still. We had to sedate him because when you're on the ventilator, you don't want him to be agitated. And his father, an ordained minister, had performed a union ceremony between my patient and his girlfriend. And they had like a ring exchange. I put the ring on her, and then I put the ring she had for him on my patient. Next day, he was no better, and I told the family, we have to take him off the ventilator. He doesn't want to be on this. We had explored the possibility of an emergency lung transplant, but that was not an option. So the family agreed, but I said, we can't just take him off the ventilator because he's sedated. We have to lift the sedation. So we stopped the sedative medications, and the next day he was awake on the ventilator, and I came back by to see him, and he wanted to write to me because he couldn't talk. He had his tube stuck in his throat. And he writes, when will you keep your promise? My heart sinks to the floor. I said, well, I thought you had a chance to live, so we had you intubated, but tomorrow we're going to take you off the ventilator, and whatever happens, happens. And then I said, is this as bad as you thought it was going to be? And he nods. And my heart sank even lower. So the next day, we took him off the ventilator, and he survived. And we had a chance to talk over the coming days and weeks. Hey, what do you think about the fact that I didn't listen to your wish? He says, I'm glad you didn't listen. I want to live. And I thought to myself, oh my, what does this tell us about advanced directives if the patient might change his mind? And I talked about this at medical conferences. I've explained I wouldn't have made the same choice for every one of my patients. I knew him really well, and I made the choice based on what I think he would have wanted. There were other patients with cystic fibrosis who wanted to die, and I said I thought it was the right choice. I remember a 14-year-old girl who, for 5 years, she did everything she could not to cooperate with her treatments. And she was young, so she was forced, but at 14, she was, the kids mature fairly quickly because they have a serious illness. At 14, she said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to live anymore. She'd had a bad home life, and we tried help. And I said, well, it's your choice. It's your life. And she decided to stop taking care of herself, withdraw care. And I told her mother, better that you go along with her and support her in this decision as opposed to keep fighting her, because every day was miserable to both of them. And she was dead within a month. She would have died anyway. It might have been longer if her mother had fought her, but for what purpose? This girl did not want to live. My patient I'm telling you about today did. So that's one part of the story. Half a year later, after he recovered, he started having nightmares of coughing up blood again. And I thought that he might be afraid of dying. And I offered to use hypnosis to help him figure out what the nightmares were about. So I told him, go into hypnosis and imagine the nightmare, and When you get to the part where you're coughing up blood, dream on to the end to find out what the dream means. Because typically when you have nightmares, a way of resolving them is to complete the dream. So he did the hypnosis, came out, and he said, I found out the dream has two endings. In one ending, I lived, and in one ending, I died. But what I found out was, no matter what ending it has, the period of suffering related to coughing up blood would be short-lived. And that's made me feel a lot better. And he again showed me that his fear was not dying. His fear was suffering, or not suffering. So another half year goes by, and I am at home, and he calls me there. It's the only time he ever called me at home. And he said, my girlfriend broke up with me. Oh, no, I said, that's the girlfriend he pulled through the year before. What happened? Well, her parents told her she shouldn't keep going out with this guy. He's going to die at a young age. I'm so sorry, I said. And I'm going to commit suicide, he said. Why? I asked. He said, I have fought a good battle. I almost died before. I know what that feels like. I don't want to go through that again. I don't want to put another girl through this because it's not fair to her. So I don't want another girlfriend. So, you know, God will understand. Well, do you know how you're going to commit suicide? He said, yeah, I'm going to take an overdose of pills. I said, have you told anybody else? No. So I didn't know what to do. I usually don't field suicide calls. When I tell this part of the story, people think he was calling me to rescue him. But I didn't feel that way. I thought he was calling me to tell me because we were very close, and that was the right thing to do, to share this decision. But I wasn't sure what to say, and I said to him, well, I have to go to synagogue. My son is reading Torah in a few moments. Can I call you back in a couple of hours? He said, yes. So I went to the synagogue, and I asked my rabbi there, I said, Rabbi, here's a story. What would you do? He said, oh, those teenagers, they break up and think the world is over, and 3 weeks later they have a new girlfriend. And I thought to myself, well, this is different. This is a young man who has a terminal disease. He knows what it's like to almost die. He knows the pain of losing a girlfriend. Who am I to impose upon him, I could try to prevent him from committing suicide, but who am I to impose my values on him? Now, when I present this in medical conferences, I ask the audience, as I'm going to ask you, what would you do? I'm about to call him back. I'm going to tell him that we can bring him to the hospital. We can have the psychiatric service see him. I can work with him to help him feel better. But if he says, I'm still going to go through the suicide, do you call the police to prevent him from doing so? Or do you let him do what he wants to do? And when I ask this question, typically the answer is people call the police. That's what you're supposed to do. If somebody is suicidal, they're not in the right frame of mind, and you want to stop them from doing so until you stabilize them. But I thought this situation was different. I thought he was rationally depressed. He had every reason to feel poorly, and he had every reason to not want to live. That kind of makes sense. And I did not feel that it was right for me to impose on him my values. So I called him. And we talked. I told him he could come into the hospital. And I told him, a year ago, I had to decide for you whether you should live or die. And I remember this quote from the Bible. I set before you life and death, choose life. And I urge you to choose life yourself, but that's your choice, not mine. He said he would think about it. The next day, I called him, and he said, okay, I've decided not to go through with the suicide. At 3:00, come into the hospital. It was a 4th of July weekend, so we said we'd wait a couple more days till the hospital was back in full gear. 2 days later, he said, I'm fine. I don't need to go in the hospital. And then 3 weeks later, he had a new girlfriend. My rabbi was right. So in this story, I'm telling you about the ethical problems I had or decision I had to make. It's interesting that the people who would have called the police when he was suicidal are the same ones who would have let him die the year before. So I think that's inconsistent. I think for myself that I respect his autonomy to make his own decisions, except in the situation when he was comatose, I had to make the decision for him, and as I guess it turned out, I made the right decision for him because he told me, hey, I want to live, even though that was a little bit different than what he said before he was intubated. So this is a case that has taught me a lot over the years, I've used it with many, many people, and it's too bad that the people didn't get a chance to read a lot of it on Psychology Today, but now at least you all know about it. When we return in a few moments from our break, I will tell you another case that was presented in two parts on Psychology Today, and this was, I'll give you a teaser, it's about a young man who presented with dizziness that nobody could help until he learned how to do hypnosis of the dizziness. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. Or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California, and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
Every year since opening Centerpoint Medicine, Dr. Ron Ambar has been overwhelmed with demand for his services, so much so that he has established a first-of-its-kind franchise opportunity. As a franchise owner of the leading pediatric hypnosis counseling center in the U.S., you'll be at the forefront of an exciting sector of healthcare as you increase your revenue. With low overhead and full support, it's your time to take advantage of this franchise opportunity. Just call 858-997-3196. That's 858-997-3196.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Unbar. We're talking about the bottom 10 articles that were published in Psychology Today over the past couple of years. I hope you found the first story interesting. So now I'm going to tell you about a young man who was, I believe, 12 when I met him. And his story was that he hated roller coasters and nonetheless went on a roller coaster ride when his friends cajoled him to do so. And when he came, and he hated the ride. When he came off the ride, he felt very dizzy, couldn't stand up, and just collapsed to the ground. And the dizziness continued. And he was put in a wheelchair. He went to the hospital. They checked him out. They thought his middle ear was damaged or something like that. And they said, there's nothing we can do. The dizziness will just have to go away on its own after a while. After 3 weeks of this, his mother contacted me, and she said, hey, do you think hypnosis could work for this? And I thought to myself, well, hypnosis can work for anything the mind controls, and dizziness is in the mind, so why not? Let's give it a go. I should say that actually there's a philosophy here. I'm quite open to using hypnosis in settings that aren't, evidence-based, because there's so much stuff we don't have evidence for. Some of my colleagues might disagree with that because, one early on in my career, one of my colleagues said, well, if you don't know it's going to work, why would you do it? Because the patient might become upset if it doesn't work. And I think it's all how you frame it. So if you tell the patient, hey, let's give this a whirl, if it doesn't work, that's okay. We gave it our shot. So I said, yeah, let's bring him in. So he came in, and he told me his story, and he said, I have to get better in 10 days. Why in 10 days? Because I have a modeled United Nations competition that I've been working on for months, and I need to win the golden gavel. Well, 10 days, that's pretty fast, but okay, I'll do what we can. So I will teach you the skills we have in rapid succession. So the first skill I taught was a positive talk, to say things like, rather than I feel dizzy, is say something like, I want to feel steady on my feet. Or rather than saying, I'm scared, say, I want to feel brave. So I taught him how to use positive talk and use it right away. And immediately he was somewhat better. He was able to actually stand up and waddle across the room on his own, whereas before he was too dizzy to stand up. So we had him come back a couple days later because we were under this time pressure, and we taught him self-hypnosis. Self-hypnosis, in his case, was thinking of a calm place where he can relax, and you imagine that place with including what he could see there and hear and smell and feel and taste, which makes it seem more real. And then he learned how to pick a gesture, like crossing his fingers, and the instruction was whenever he crosses his fingers, he can become relaxed even when he's not doing hypnosis. This is a post-hypnotic suggestion. So I taught him that. And with that, he improved. He was able to get up from the couch, walk a bit, and over the next 2 or 3 days, he was able to walk quite a bit with assistance. So his mother decided he actually walked a couple miles. So much better. And the dizziness is much improved. He then comes back for his third lesson. Now this is 3 days before the Model United Nations competition. And I teach him how to interact with his subconscious. And his subconscious says, I know why he's dizzy, but I can't get into it right now. It's too complicated. And then the answer to my question, subconscious, yes, I can help fix the remaining dizziness. I said, go ahead. And it did. And he got up in my office, danced around, completely steady, went to the Model United Nations competition, won the golden gavel. Excellent. And 3 days later, he was in his father's car. I had taken a nap, and he woke up suddenly, and he was panicking, hyperventilating, racing heart, afraid he's going to die. And he came back to see me the next day. I said, well, that's interesting. I said, you know, you came with dizziness. Dizziness went away. Then you had this panic episode out of the blue. So what must be going on is that whatever caused your dizziness is still not resolved. It's just coming out in a different way because all we did was treat the symptom. And one of the most important things I teach residents and other physicians is that you need to address the cause of the problem rather than the symptom. Otherwise, it can keep coming back. So I asked the subconscious, are you ready to tell us what's going on? And it said, yes. And I said, okay, what's happening? Why was he dizzy? Why did he panic? And the kid said, I see a World War II plane crashing. So says subconscious talk in imagery. So that's an interesting image. What does it mean? And through some questioning, we determined that the pilot of the plane was very scared, and we further determined that this was a past life of my patient, and that he had died in a plane crash. And the roller coaster ride activated his reactivated his fear, because it reminded him of the plane crash. And the reason he panicked in his father's car is he dreamt of the Indiana Jones movie where Indiana crashes in an airplane, and that reminded him again, and this way he panicked. So how do you deal with that? And by the way, you have to figure out solutions on your feet, because they don't teach you in medical school or psychology school what to do with different situations. This is the creative part. So we decided to go back, he and I, current he and I, into the past, and reassured the pilot that, well, while he dies, he'll be fine. He gets to live on in my patient. The pilot liked that, and that was the end of the panic episode. This boy later took a trip to the Far East and flew lots of small planes and had no further issues with panic or dizziness. So again, it's really, really interesting to see how symptoms like dizziness or panic represent something behind it, and through hypnosis and talking to subconscious, we can sort of unravel the mystery and figure out how to best solve it. Another fun story with the same patient is that he was a poet, and I suggested his subconscious can help him write poetry, which it did, and he wrote some very, very sophisticated poems that did not appear to come from the mind of a 12-year-old, or I think he might have been 13 at this point, and his subconscious said, well, the boy said he felt like he was channeling the poems. The poems just came into his mind, and he wrote them down, and his subconscious said that the poems came from muses out there, wherever muses are, and gave him the idea of what to write. And I've since learned that great poets talk about channeling as a way of becoming creative, and I wondered if this young man exhibited that. So those are a couple of stories, again, that I thought were fascinating, taught me a lot, and were in the bottom 10 of hypnosis blogs on Psychology Today. So we'll start out, we have time to start out on another story, another blog, which we'll start and continue after the break. And I guess I see the break is coming up shortly, so I'll just tell you that it's about the importance of how we label ourselves. How we label ourselves has a big impact regarding how we manifest ourselves. And this actually echoes what the Buddha said 2,700 years ago. He said, what we think is what we become. What we think is what we become. And I'll give you some examples of how patients use that to their advantage or disadvantage. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unber.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Every year since opening CenterPoint Medicine, Dr. Ron Ambar has been overwhelmed with demand for his services, so much so that he has established a first-of-its-kind franchise opportunity. As a franchise owner of the leading pediatric hypnosis counseling center in the U.S., you'll be at the forefront of an exciting sector of healthcare as you increase your revenue. With low overhead and full support, it's your time to take advantage of this franchise opportunity. Just call 858-997-3196. That's 858-997-3196.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Today I'm sharing some of the blogs from the bottom 10 in Psychology Today, and I hope you found the first two stories fascinating. I certainly did. So in this particular blog was about the importance of how we describe ourselves, because what we say is what happens. This is one reason I don't like diagnosing patients so much, because when I give them a diagnosis, they believe it. And then they could play the role. So for example, a patient might be told, you have asthma. And then every time they get out of breath, they feel, oh, this is my asthma. And yet their shortness of breath might be related to being out of condition or being anxious. And when they treat the shortness of breath with asthma medication, it doesn't work. And then they start panicking because the asthma must be really bad. So that's an example of a label causing a problem. Another example is a kid might be told, you have dyslexia, you can't read well. And then they say, well, I have dyslexia, so I must be stupid. And, if I'm stupid, I don't have to work hard at school because it doesn't make a difference anyway. And you can set them off in the wrong pattern. Better to say, in the case of the kid with asthma, you have shortness of breath that maybe you can improve using your asthma medication or relaxing in your mind. And that child with dyslexia is, no, you're very smart. You have to learn to read a different way, but you can do it because you're smart. So I'm going to tell you about three short patient cases that illustrate how self-labeling can be harmful. The first case was a young man with autism. He was about 12 years old. And he came to see me. He had a behavioral outbursts at school, and he felt he could not control them. He caused such a ruckus that he ended up being transferred from a regular public school to a school with behaviorally challenged children. And there it got even worse, because this young man actually was quite highly intelligent, and he was bored to tears in the school geared to kids who have behavioral challenges, but many of them had cognitive challenges as well. So when I met him, I taught him some self-regulation skills. I taught him how to calm himself with hypnosis, how to talk to his subconscious. And then I said to him, I said to the parents, we have to transfer him to a regular school because he's not challenged at this school for behaviorally challenged kids. But we need to get him an aide to help deal with his outbursts, if he still has them. And they listened, and they did it. And he went back to regular school. He did well. And actually, the fun part was that several years later, he came by. He said, hey, I want you to know I'm a student now at a major university, and I'm going to be applying to law school. And I really want to thank you for convincing my parents to send me to regular school. So here's a kid that was labeled with autism because he did have autism, but they treated the label. They said he can't control himself. He believed he couldn't control himself, and this led him down a very bad life path. I would have rather that they had thought of him as a smart young man with autism, not an autistic person, but with autism, and that the job with him was to help him deal with his challenges, and then once he surmounted them successfully, he was very successful. Switching gears, this next story is about a Jewish boy who was 11. He went to school. He was confronted with anti-Semitism. Somebody said something inappropriate to him. He felt very bad. He went to the school principal to complain. His mother came in to see me with him, and she said he was a victim of anti-Semitism. And I said he was not a victim. Don't label him with that. Because if you're a victim, that means you're powerless. He might have been victimized by anti-Semitism, or he might have confronted Semitism, but he could do things about it. He was able to tell the principal, who then talked to the offending classmate. And in our society, being a victim sometimes is glorified. In this world, being victims, you know, you hurt me, you have to fix me. The problem with being a victim is it takes away your initiative to do something about it. You feel helpless. I think sometimes people like being victims because then they don't have to take responsibility, because taking responsibility can be difficult, can be hard. But I think it ends up putting people into boxes. And so I urge you to avoid using that kind of descriptor for yourself or for other people. If somebody's in a bad situation, what can they do about it? How can we help them help themselves? That kind of approach. This particular young man, as I was talking to him, is interesting. He said, well, I have a solution. Maybe I just won't be Jewish anymore. That way I won't have to deal with anti-Semitism. And we had to talk about that, too. I asked him, why would you want to be Jewish? He didn't know. And so I gave him some ideas of why he might want to be. I told him about what the Jewish people have accomplished in the world, and how America was founded on Judeo-Christian principles. And by the time we finished, he said, I'm proud to be Jewish. I want to be Jewish. And he has since gone on to study a lot more about the culture and the religion. The message here is don't take on the victim label. And then the final example is a young lady. She was 5 years old. She was an artist, and she really was at five, very, very talented. But she thought of herself as a bad artist. Why was she bad? Because when she tried to draw things, she was also a perfectionist. They never came out perfectly, and she'd get so frustrated and so angry at herself. There's torn pages and crumpled paper all over the house because the drawings didn't come out the way she wanted them to go. So I said, this is interesting. So I showed her a plate I have in my office. It's a kintsugi plate. That's spelled K-I-N-T-S-U-G-I. It's Japanese art. And what it is they take plates or other objects that are cracked, that are defective in some way, and then they coat it with gold or other precious metal paint to make it look nicer, and then they display it. It's a form of art. The plate does not look perfect, but it looks really, really nice. It reminded me, I don't know if you know the painter Bob Ross, he talked about happy little accidents when a drop of paint came on a painting that he didn't intend to have. Rather than saying, oh no, I ruined it, he would work that drop into the painting. So he made it something good out of it. So the concept for this young lady, rather than thinking you're a poor artist, when something doesn't work out the way you want to, fix it, and that way it'll be just right. And she took that in, and indeed, she was no longer a poor artist. She was a good artist, who was able to make her art look better even when there were mistakes in it. So she shed the poor artist label. What labels do you pick for yourself? If there's something about yourself that you don't like, let's say you think you're stupid, hopefully not, you can tell yourself, I want to become smarter. And just by saying, I want to become smarter, or I can become smarter, your brain starts working in that direction. And that's why it's so important to label yourself with positive, helpful descriptors. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Unber.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. Or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. We've been talking about the bottom 10 blogs, and I hope some of you are thinking, well, if those are the bottom 10, the others might be much better. And I actually don't think so. I think the blogs are pretty similar. It's just that sometimes, by the stroke of luck, they're popular, and other times they're not. So in this last segment, we usually talk about things that you can do at home, and I want to review a blog with you that I wrote. It was entitled Inaccuracies About Health in the Media. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about why people hear so many contrarian headlines in the news about health-related issues and why this occurs, and then what you can do as a consumer to figure it out. What should I believe? And I guess I should start off with a headline. The problem is that you as a consumer is, unless you read the original article, and unless you have some sophistication in analyzing results, you won't be able to figure out what to believe. And so part of the I'll give you the answer first. If you're not medically sophisticated, check with a trusted medical advisor. So the purpose of me going through what kind of mistakes are made is so you can understand why they occur, why you get contradictory headlines. For example, there are headlines that say, lack of serotonin causes depression. And then the headline just says, serotonin has nothing to do with depression. There's a contradictory. Or mRNA vaccines have been essential for controlling COVID. And the headlines have said, mRNA vaccines cause more deaths than they prevent. Or colonoscopies can help prevent death from colorectal cancer. Or colonoscopies may not be effective at preventing deaths from cancer. These are all contradictory headlines. What are you supposed to do with them? So let's dive in, and I'll give you some examples of why you get these contradictions. Let's start with the colonoscopy one. The headline was, it was actually fairly recent, colonoscopies may not be effective at preventing deaths from cancer. Does that mean we should stop having colonoscopies? That would seem to be the implication. And unfortunately, when you get headlines like that, people actually believe them. You know, people believe there's been Martians on Earth and all sorts of crazy things. So you get a medical headline, you start believing it. But I read the article, and what it says was that when people are recommended to have colonoscopies, they don't get them done, and therefore they're not very effective. That's what the article actually said. So colonoscopies, when they're done, do help prevent cancer. But if you don't do them, guess what? They don't help. And that's what the article basically said. But then the headlines were misleading by saying, well, I guess what the headline should have read is, recommendations for colonoscopies are not effective because people don't follow them. So a trivial example, and yet it hit the headlines. So you don't want to just read the headline. You want to actually look into the article. Let me talk to you about it. Let's say I'm testing a new drug. So this is going to be a hypothetical example. Okay. So I'm testing a new drug, and I tested on a bunch of patients, and I find out that it didn't do much. And the headline is, new drug does little to treat whatever disease. But unless you read the article, you wouldn't realize they only tested this drug in patients with a very mild version of disease. So let's say the disease was asthma, and I was trying a new medicine for asthma, and the only people I put into the studies had very mild asthma that doesn't even need medication. So, of course, the new drug won't help at all. And so that's the headline that come out of it. The flip side could happen is you have a new drug, and you only study patients with severe disease, and it works really, really well. And the headline will read, new drug really helps patients, let's say, with asthma. And you say, oh, that's great. Except most patients with asthma have mild disease. They don't need the new drug with its side effects and costs. And that's missed in the headlines. So the same drug, same patient's asthma, but with mild disease, it doesn't work at all. With severe disease, it works great, but it's not applicable to most patients. So not every patient shouldn't go in and give me that drug, it works so well. So you have to know what the study is studying, and what kind of patients it applies to, and does that apply to you? Again, the only way to know that is to read the study in detail, and most of us don't have the time or take the time or have the knowledge to analyze this. Another example of this kind of problem is this. You've heard about the RSV vaccine. It's been out this year, respiratory syncytial virus vaccine. It's a respiratory problem. And before we had the vaccine, we had therapies you could administer in the hospital, and it was important to figure out, does somebody have RSV or not? Because if you did, you give them the therapy. So kids would be tested for the RSV when they came into the hospital. It usually affected young kids, although it also affects the elderly. And based on the results, they would treat them or not. But every medical test has what's called a sensitivity and a specificity. What that means is that if you have the disease and your test detects it well, then it's a very sensitive test. And if you don't have the disease and a test says you don't have the disease, then it's very specific. So you follow, when you do a test, if you have the disease, you want it to pick it up, and if you don't have the disease, you don't want to say you have the disease when you don't. That's what the ideal test would be, 100% foolproof both ways, but there's no such thing as ideal. So a good test might be 95% sensitive, so 95 to 100 times will actually say you have the disease when you have it, and it might be 95% specific, which means 95% of the time when you don't have the disease, it says you don't have a disease. But then you have some false results. All right, so you have this test for RSV, and it's not perfect like any other medical test, and it's the middle of RSV season. So every other person has RSV. And you do the test, and the test says you don't have RSV. Does that mean you withhold the care? Well, no. Why is that? Because most everybody comes in with, let's say, runny nose and fever, has RSV. So if the test said you didn't have RSV, it's probably false. Even though the test is 95% specific, it's usually right when you say it's that you don't have RSV. In the case when most everybody has RSV, when you have a negative result, it's mostly false. And now let's switch it to the summer season, where hardly anybody has RSV. In the summertime, RSV is basically unknown. It doesn't happen. It's a fall-winter disease. You do the test in the summertime, and it says you have RSV. Well, chances are it's a false positive, because like nobody has RSV in the summer, so if it says you do, it's probably a mistake. So the conclusion is, in the summertime and in the wintertime, there's no reason to do this test, because if it doesn't show what you expect, it's probably false. The only time this test is useful is maybe in the fall, where half the people have RSV and half don't. So you see what I'm sharing with you. It's a very complicated situation of how to interpret medical studies and medical tests, and requires level of sophistication most people don't have. Nothing wrong with that. It just takes a lot of study, and that's why you need to rely on a trusted medical advisor. It's been a pleasure talking with you today. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.